We are up to Shmuel Bet Perek Chaf Dalet, chapter 24. And we are starting with Pasuk Yud Aleph. That's where we left off. Okay. Now, we have a good opportunity here to compare the end of David's life in two different places of Tanakh. One, of course, is the end of Shmuel Bet and the beginning of Melachim Aleph. And the other is Divrei Hayamim. And the description of the last months or a few years of David's life is significantly different one from the other. And that is a function of the different agendas that the two books have in presenting the life of David. Not too dissimilar from, let's say, the different agendas of two news organizations presenting the same story, one deciding to concentrate on certain elements, and the other concentrating on the elements that serves its purposes and its, let's say, viewership or sponsors. And they might both be telling some element of truth. In the case of Tanakh, of course, every pasuk in Tanakh is telling us the truth. But at the same time, there is a willful, I can't call it a distortion, but a willful omission. Divrei Hayamim starts a perek just the same way that the perek of Bathsheba starts, and then it just starts with that perek, that they went to battle. And that was it. It doesn't say what happened in that battle, or that David saw a woman during that battle whose husband was at battle. It doesn't tell us any of that. It just skips over the whole Bathsheba story. Because Divrei Hayamim's agenda is not to concentrate on those kind of things, right? The agenda at the end of Shmuel Bet, starting with Perek Gimel, which is the Perek right after the prophet Nosson lists a whole series of punishments and penances that David will have to serve as a result of his indiscretion. The rest of Shmuel Bet, and I might add the beginning of Shmuel Melachim Aleph for that matter, is dedicated to show how David served that penance and how he atoned for that maisa. Okay. It says, Gam Hashem Hevir Eschatos Cholo Tamus. God is bearing your iniquity, you will not die. But at the same point, at the same time, you will have some degree of punishment, some reminder of this, practically everything that happens to you for the rest of your life. David doesn't have a moment of rest. So, but one would, of course, not get that picture of Divrei Hayamim because Divrei Hayamim doesn't even mention Bathsheba. So the final days of David are quite glorious as he sets up the building of the Beis HaMikdash. He recites very famous prayers. They're part of our liturgy. The beginning and the end of Psukei Dezimra for Ashkenazim we have the bookends. Psukei Dezimra are prayers of David in Divrei Hayamim at the advent of the completion of the base the completion of the preparations for the base of Mikdash, put it that way. All right, so again, this I'm just reporting to you that Tanakh, it's fair game for Tanakh to do this. There might be a different agenda of Sefer Tehillim presenting particular story of certain events, especially between chapter 50 and 60 in a certain derech that might elaborate on certain elements of what happened in Shmuel and might omit certain elements. Right? Famous question that in all the Prakim and Tehillim about Yetzias Mitzrayim and its aftermath, chapter 78, 105, 106, there's no reference to Korach. All three of them make reference to sins in the desert, and Doson, Vaviram, and the earth swallowing up all of those who took part in the rebellion. But it just doesn't mention Korach, right? All right. So you know whatever the scholars make out of that, I think it's obvious why Tehillim doesn't like to mention Korach. Would anyone like to venture how do you explain the subjective reporting of Sefer Tehillim to make such a big deal about what Dasan Vaviram did, but say nothing about what Korach did? Korach was the one who started the rebellion. Right? So I'm using this as an example for how Divrei Yomim is very subjective about the life of David. It only concentrates on the positive. Why would Tehillim never mention Korach? You should see what the insane Bible critics do about that. Ugh, it's so crazy. They have an agenda to drive, and they don't care how ridiculous it sounds. But okay, what do you think?
Was it maybe so as not to give him too much credit? Because sometimes they say, like, if you start up something, you don't want to give too much credit to that person.
I think that's being too complicated. It's something simpler than that. Why would Tehillim, if you daven today, you davened the full davening today, all the way to the end, you should have the answer.
Huh.
Zach?
David wrote Tehillim. With that in mind, you got me blank, Rabbi. I'm sorry.
David wrote Tehillim with the assistance, says the Gemara in Baba Basra, of Korach's descendants.
Oh, that's right. Maskil LeKorach David. Yes.
Today's
Tehillim. Right.
Today's Yom Rishei. Yom Rishei. Yes. On Matzeach Livnei Korach.
Yes.
Right? So a lot of Prokim and Tehillim begin with the words Bnei Korach. And the Gemara Mizmor of Yudal Amadei says that Korach's descendants, Shmuel was one of them, helped David write Sefer Tehillim. So right. I get it. David didn't want to disrespect, Bnei Korach,
right,
who became tzaddikim, right, by making reference to their elder Zayda. So he kept Korach out of it, and he only mentioned Dustin Binner. Okay, I got off on that tangent just now, just to impress upon you the importance of accepting the fact that while we may not like objective reporting in the newsroom, because they're supposed to be objective, right? We don't like subjective reporting when we're just supposed to get the news and let us interpret it. There could be something called news commentary, but all the news is commentary these days. But in Tanakh, there is such a thing. Yeah, there is such a subjective. Certainly in the Midrashim, but I'm talking now in the biblical text itself and how it presents things. Okay, so the 24th chapter begins with David counting Bnei Yisrael. The last time we did this was before Shavuos and Memorial Day, and I had a wedding, so there was a lot of Mondays we missed, I'm sorry. And a week from tonight, I'm already going to be on a plane at this time towards Israel. So we're trying to work on a schedule for the 3 weeks when we return. But this will close out our study of Shmuel Bet. And the question of what was so wrong with counting Bnei Yisrael, so a lot of different commentaries weigh in on this. What's wrong with counting Bnei Yisrael? And where do we derive the fact that what David was doing was wrong? I mean, you can't punish someone for doing something unless he should have known better, right? When David tells Yoav to count, Yoav responds as if though this is not a good thing to do. But wait a second, Bnei Yisrael counted so many times. The battles where Bnei Yisrael counted, right? Yeah, because you have to know if you have an enemy with a certain amount of people, you have to know how many troops to send. Every battle ever fought knows you got to send 20,000 over that hill, and you got to take that city with 4,000, and then it's all over safe for Yehoshua and Shoftim. Right? But that's not what David was counting for. David was counting, at least this is where Rabbanel presents it, he was counting for Gaiva to know how many people are paying me taxes, how many people am I ruling over, how many, you know, it was, and then you put a phenomenal Ayin Hara upon yourself.
Right. Isn't David though the one that said in Tehillim, I'm less than a worm? I mean, David is known for his anivus, right? Over all other character traits. It's odd that you would say that it was a gaiva.
Yes, it is odd. David
reason.
at the time he wrote that perek was indeed the David we know, who with all his grandeur was indeed in his heart the humble little harp player. But on this day, He closes out his tenure in Sefer Shmuel with an act of gaiva that could not be suppressed. I will tell you, I'm not going to get into it now, but if you have a chance to look at the Ramban, the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, which of course is called the Book of Numbers, where he discusses this whole issue, and I've given shiur so many times on this over the years, over how we derive not to count Bnei Israel. It's actually the Haftorah of last week that we read in Chutz Laaretz from Sefer Hosea, that the Gemara in the second parak in Yuma actually discusses at great length regarding the prohibition of counting Jews. The Rambam actually paskins this way. He paskins in Sehilchos Tmidin Musafin that when you count Jews, you must do so with a census. You have to count, let's say, envelopes that are mailed in, or you have to count half shekels or some kind of picadon or pottery shards or sheep or so, whatever it might be, that represent the person. Okay, you can count ties, you can count yarmulkes. Right? Some people count with using a pasuk or something like that. So that's how we derive this. And the proof is that, look, David counts and is told by the prophet God. That's Pasuk Aleph, with which we're starting. But Dvar Hashem Haya El God Hanavi said David Lemor.
Rabbi Schwartz, what is the reason for such counting? What is the real reason for such counting? Not by person, but by something which represents a person.
So the Gemara asks that question. It says, because Hoshea said, "B'lohayim ispar bnei Israel, asher lo yimad v'lo yisafer." The prophet said it. Zeres HaKosov, don't count Jews, because it's an ayin hara.
That's all. Okay.
God is fighting for you. You don't need to know. Now, this has a lot of different interpretations and different directions for what David did wrong. I just gave you a Barbanel, which is simple, and because there are just too many other places where we're counted. It's hard to imagine that in each one of them, they gave a half a shekel or something over. Right? So this is, I mean, a teacher has to know how many students are in his class, to know how many books to order or how many pamphlets to make up. You know, you can't, although I do remember that in graduation, you know, in the Jewish studies teachers, you know, every dean has to go step forth and say how many students are graduating. So in Jewish studies, they always say, B'li Ayin Hara, 242 students are graduating. As long as you say B'li Ayin Hara, it's almost like if you can talk business and Shabbos, as long as you precede your words with the words Nis Shabbos Geret, and then you could talk all the business you want. But some too, and if you're counting your grandchildren, as long as you say B'li Ayin Hara, all right, then you can tell how many grandchildren you have. Right. So as long as you're sensitive, right, to the now what Ayin Hara is in itself requires its own shares, but please. I'd like to stick to Sefer Shmuel. All right, it says that God was Chose David. The very first time that God appears is actually in Shmuel Aleph. God appears before Nasan. Okay, I think I concluded the last shir by reading the next to last pasuk in Divrei Yomim Aleph that says that the stories of David can be found in the prophecies of Shmuel HaRoeh, God HaChose, Nasan HaNavi, and God HaChose. So there's what we call Sefer Shmuel, where we know there are two of them. That's a Christian formulation. But that Sefer Shmuel in its entirety was written by three Nevi'im. After all, Shmuel himself dies in Shmuel Aleph, right? So God appeared in Shmuel Aleph, Sefer Shmuel Aleph, where David was fleeing Shaul and was told by God, out of nowhere, it says the Chose God told David, don't go there. If you go there, sure, we'll catch you. Go turn and go into a different direction. Right? So God was like the Chose of David. He was David's, let's say, guardian angel of sorts. But here, he is told, Haloch v'dibarta el David ko'amar Hashem, shalosh anochi notel alecha, b'char locha achas mehan ve'eselach. Nasan says, and God says to David, you choose three, one of three of these, and one of them you're going to have to sustain. Vayavo God el David bayaged lo bayamer lo hatavo locha sheva shanim ra'av, 7 years of Rav. Oh my goodness, David had just experienced 3 years of Rav, for which he allowed seven descendants of Shaul to be hanged. No, I'm not going to choose that. Sheva shanim ra'av ba'artzecha, I can't do that. Im shlosha chodoshim, Nuscha lefnei tzarecha, or 3 months fleeing from your enemies. Right, now that's also can be not just people chasing David, but the whole army. Right? The who wrote fecha? They're going to chase after you. Behimehayos shloshes yamim deber ba'artzecha, or 3 days of pestilence. Now, the first two David had experienced, right? He just had experienced Ra'av. He had fled from Avshalom, right? Or 3 days of Dever, pestilence. That's the fifth of the plagues in Egypt, right? Dever. Shloshes yomim Dever ba'artzecha. Pestilence. Pandemic. Ato da'u re'e ma'ashiv sholchi davar. Choose, and I'll tell them which one you choose. Vayomer David el Gad, famous answer, this is Tachanun. Tzar li ma'od niflod na b'yad Hashem ki rabim rachamav u'b'yad adam ale pola. So this is what we say, ironically, fall on our hands, right? So it's called nefilas apayim, because David says, let me fall in God's hands, because he will certainly have mercy on me, something that my enemies, if they chase after me, will not have. I don't want to go, I don't want to die that way. And he didn't choose the Ra'av, perhaps, says Radak, because Ra'av would give him an unfair advantage. The king has lots of food in his palace to last for 7 years. But Ra'av, people will die slowly. Who knows what's going to happen? We just had a Ra'av for 3 years. I can't sustain that. And that's a long time, 7 years. Let's take our chances with 3 days of pestilence. After all, 3 days will pass quickly. So he chooses the pestilence, right? Vayitein Hashem Dever b'Yisrael. Right? Notice that David just says, let me fall in the hands of God. Because apparently pestilence, certainly ancient man accepted the fact that pestilence, they couldn't see what it was. It's just like an act of God, right? Ra'av is more right in front of us. Ra'av we can see. Ra'av maybe as a result of bad planning or not storing enough water. Ra'av we can affect. But pestilence, that's why in Mitzrayim, listen, there's a word that never appears again in the whole Tanakh. Hine Yad Hashem Hoya b'miknecha. Sound familiar? Hine Yad Hashem Hoya b'miknecha. The only time in the Torah where the word the present to be is used. Hoya means is. There's no is in Hebrew, right? Hine Yad Hashem Hoya. Hey Vav Yud Hey. So what does it mean? Because that the hand of God is already in the animals. The viruses are there. It's just it takes a little time for it to have an effect and to spread. So you choose Dever, okay. It's going to take 3 days for the effect. We're going to see that the whole damage took only 6 hours. Right? But that's I'm just trying to explain why it's in the hand of God. The hand of God is already in your animals. If you choose to free my people, God will just snap his fingers and all those viruses will disappear. But if you don't let them go, then that those viruses that are already in your animals will make their way and harm them. Okay, so and we all know that there are some viruses that will kill animals that won't kill people, and vice versa. Right? So that's why the fifth plague, Dever, affected animals but didn't affect the people. That was the point. Okay. So it says that the Dever spread from the morning till midday and from dawn to Be'er Sheva, usually it's the terminology from north to south, those are the main population centers, 70,000 people, Shivim Elef Ish. Oh my goodness. The Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, I believe, the end of Brachas. The Gemara at the end of Brachas says that Yoav's brother Avishai died then. He was shackled for Shiva Melech. Pshat is Pshat. Killed a lot of people. And the angel came to spread its dever upon Jerusalem itself. Rabata, Herif Yadecha. There's some imagery of this in the Haggadah, in the Pesach Haggadah. And the angel of God appeared at a certain granary at the top of a mountain that was still occupied by a Jebusite king named Aravna. Okay, we know from Sefer Yehoshua that the Jews did not conquer a city called Jerusalem, and the Yevusi continued to live there. They seem to have been quite subservient to David. Why David conquered all of Jerusalem from the Yevusi in Shmuel Bet Perek Hey, but left this mountain unconquered, is dealt with by Radak, which I'm about to share with you shortly, based on the Psikta. And David and this Arav Nahayevusi seem to be on friendly terms. Okay. Before I get to the Radak, there is a Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah about Avraham forging a pact with the Yevusi. And we know that's not in Tanakh, but we do know from Parshas Vayera that David did forge a pact with the Plishtim. Okay. It's just interesting that David so badly wanted peace that he was willing to make a pact with people who inhabited land that God had already promised him in chapter 15, Bereishis, that this is the land I'm going to bequeath to your descendants. Rashbam makes the amazing claim that the Akedas Yitzchak story that takes place right after David cedes land to the Philistines and says, "You, this is your land, this is my land, let's live in peace together," that it says, "V'elokim nisah es Avraham." Rashbam says that it means that God put Avraham to the test as a punishment for ceding land that was already bequeathed to him in the land of the Plishtim. It's not yours to give up. How many children of yours are going to die defending this land? You're so quick to give up land, give up your son. That's Rashbam. Amazing, amazing parish. I wonder what he would think about politics today. All right. But anyway, that is, and it's based on a Medrash also. Okay. If you have a chance to look up Rashbam, you'll see the end of Vayera. So the Yevusi, it's ironic. The Yevusi is East Jerusalem and Plishtim is Gaza. So, you know, the two places that Avraham, you know, in his defense, he so badly wanted peace at the time that he felt this idea that if I need to sit down at a table and talk to the Plishtim, I'll make a deal with them for the time being. Right? Okay. All right. So this Goren Aravna is the topic of a long Radak at the end of Shmuel Bet, where he claims that since this story counting Bnei Yisrael ended with the purchase of the land to build the Beis HaMikdash, known as Har HaBayis, that the real problem at the end of Shmuel Bet, which David shares with his people, though, it's not just the king's obligation, it's at least the way the Radak presents it, it's an obligation on the people, is that there was a profound hisrashlus, there was a lethargy, in fulfilling what really should have been a mitzvah fulfilled long before. Remember, we're in Israel for, let's just it says 480 years from Yetzias Mitzrayim, but if you take the Cheshbonos of Sefer Shoftim, we've been in Israel over 500 years. 500 years. When we were kicked out of Israel by the Babylonians, the first thing we did when we came back was... Chevra, Sefer Ezra, Sefer Chagai.
We build the walls of Jerusalem.
Yes, build Yerushalayim. Build the Beis HaMikdash. That's the first thing we did. And now, you know, Yerushalayim went unconquered. Till David, all of Sefer Shoftim. Remember the tragic story of the Pilegesh Begiva when they wanted to spend, they didn't know where to spend the night. That's the whole problem with the Binyamin people and tormenting his wife. They wanted to spend the night in Yerushalayim. And then the guy said, no, we can't go to Yerushalayim. No Jews live there.
Yeah.
Remember that? Mm-hmm. Okay. And now it is true that when David killed Goliath, it says he cut off his head and took his head to Yerushalayim. Why would he take it to Yerushalayim? It wasn't a city. He had to. So some scholars say that there are two Yerushalayims, right? The Radak says something amazing in Yeshayahu when it says, Od Hayom Benov. Why does Yeshayahu refer to the end of days starting in Nov? So he makes an amazing claim that the Makom Asher Yivchar, the place that God shall choose, is you know, we all always refer to as Yerushalayim, but it was other cities during the middle. It was Nov and Shiloh, right? So when it says that David took the head to Yerushalayim, it really means that he took the sword and the head and whatever else he took from Goliath, because we see later that when David went to get food from the high priest, right, from the Kohen Gadol Achimelech, we see that the sword of Goliath was there. Right? He took it there as some sign of defeat of the enemy that we put in our, right, in our holy place. Okay, so David is there, so we see that the angel is about to slay Jerusalem. And Vayomer David LaHashem, Pasuk Yitzayim, Biroso es Hamalach, Hamakeh Ba'am. When David saw the angel, this means that David is a Navi, right? Or that he's sleeping. Vayomer Hinei Anochi Chatasiva, Anochi Habesi, Ve'ilatzon Me'asu, Tino Yedchabi Uvebesavi. This is David after he's been suffering quite a bit in this book. He goes, God, I'm the one who caused this problem. Why should the sheep, why should they suffer for this? Cast your anger upon me and my father's house, not upon these poor sheep. Okay, David, this is the atonement. The real reason for such a harsh punishment, the Radak says, is not so much the counting. It's the apathy, the lethargy that Bnei Israel took towards this essential mitzvah. How is God? I mean, it's true that David himself had asked to exchange the curtain for a house, and God told him he won't. That was good news for David, because at least he told him his son will. So David knows after 500 years, it's finally going to happen. Okay? But that there was no drive and no push for it from the people. Okay? Ayin Sham in the Radak at the end of Shmuel Beis. David kidvar God kasher tzivah Hashem, and he told him.
I'm sorry, Rabbi, to interrupt. But
Zach, you're not coming through well. We don't hear you. Zach, I don't. Okay, all right. So Hashem tells David to set up a mizbeach in the granary of Aravna Hayevusi. Vayal David kidvar God kasher tziva Hashem, vayashkef Aravna vayaris hamelach v'esavadav ovrim alav. So Aravna saw David and his servants coming up to Har Habayis. You can picture the topography. Doesn't say which direction he came, but you know that with whichever direction you're going uphill somewhat. Okay. Probably even at that time, there is archaeological evidence that the best way to get there is the way the buses go today, through what's called the Shara Ashbos. I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about. That entrance, we have to go through the metal detectors to get to the Kotel, right? I mean, there are two ways. You can go up from the Arab Shuk and come down the steps, but okay. Anyway, So Vayetza Aravna Vayishtachu Lamelech Arpai Apavarza. And Aravna, so obviously subservient to David, the Tanakh does not tell us anything of their relationship before this. But it's quite obvious that Aravna is somehow serving up there at the pleasure of David. He's, you know, I don't know how else to say it, but why Why didn't David just conquer him the way he conquered the rest of Yerushalayim? Okay, this is something that was left for Ashgacha Pratis for the end of the book to purchase the land. Now, the Torah says that God will choose the place. It does not mention Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is not a word in the Torah. The word Shalem is in Sefer Bereishis, and Rashi says that is Yerushalayim. But the city Yerushalayim and the fact that that would be the place that God would choose is not mentioned in the Torah because perhaps, says Ramban, for instance, the tribes would fight over it. Yerushalayim is actually like the United Nations in New York. It doesn't belong to anyone. It belongs to all the tribes. It's physically between Binyamin and Yehuda, but it belongs to all the tribes. Right? Or if the nations knew that Yerushalayim was our holy city, they'd all fight over it, like they do today. Or perhaps most convincingly, if God had said in the Torah, go to Jerusalem and offer your sacrifices there, who would have gone to Nov and Givon and Shiloh and in between and Gilgal? There were other holy places where the Mishkan stood in between. While it stood there, there was potential for that to be the holy city, right? However, in another pasuk in Sefer Devarim in Parshas Re'eh, it says, "When you go to the land, l'shichno sidrashu uvasashama, seek out a place for God, as if though we're supposed to find the place, choose it. L'shichno sidrashu uvasashama." Now, very famously, the Rambam cites different psukim to teach us that we have to build a holy place for God. The suli mikdash v'shachanti v'socham and l'shichno sidrashu uvasashama, and they may refer to either the permanent Beis HaMikdash, which is Yerushalayim, and once Yerushalayim was built, that's it. It's not going anywhere else. But there were four other places where the Mishkan stood before. Okay. So this is the this is finally the time where David is being shown the place. So this is God choosing it. Right? And but we have to make the effort in putting the materials there. This is basically where all the stories in Divrei Hayamim start, because it's only at this point where it says in Divrei Hayamim is David prepared all the building blocks and everything else that he would need to build it. He started putting it the place that God told. All right, this is where it's going to be. Now bring in all the wood and everything. Okay. All right. So Aravna is willing to give David whatever he wants. Madua ba aduni amelach pasuk chafalof. Why have you come here, Alav Dovah? Yomer David liknos meimcha es agorin, livnos mizbeach l'Hashem b'teyatzar ha-magifa me'alam ha'am. There's a terrible pestilence coming through our people, and the only way it will end is if I build a mizbeach. Now that sounds a little cultic. The way to end a pestilence is to get doctors and to quarantine and other things like that. But not in Tanakh. In Tanakh, we build the Mizbeach, and the Mizbeach is going to end this pestilence. But so that the Teyatzar HaMagefa Me'ala. Right? But notice that David says, Liknos Me'imcha, I want to buy it. I'm not going to just take it from you. So, you know, it seems that the Jebusite king is all too happy to let him have it. Relationship is needs a little explanation here. You know, the Jebusite king is so subservient to David. Listen to how he talks in Pasuk HaFez. Remember Ravna al David. Yikach v'yal aduni ha-melech ha-tov be'inav. Re'e ha-bakor lo'olav ha-morigim l'chulei ha-bakor lo'itzim. It's all here for you. You take whatever you want. You build the Mizbeach, do whatever you want, and I'm going to give you the land. I don't want you to pay for it. So this is actually a huge sugya in Maseches Avodah Zarah, Maseches Zvachim, over whether the animals we use for our kachim and our kabanos can be purchased from a Gentile. Right? From our story, it would appear that the answer is yes, can come from a Gentile. What's the problem? Is that a Gentile's animal might have killed another animal, which is certainly not worthy for a kachim. Doesn't make it unkosher if it did so in the hands of a Gentile. In the hands of a Jew, an animal that killed another animal is called a shor haniskal. It has to be killed, and its meat is forbidden, even b'hanah. The animal may have been part of a bestiality with a human being, in which case, of course, it's forbidden as a korban. Again, that does not make it unkosher. But David is using these as korbanos. So in general, there's a very, very famous shita of Eliezer that says that you can't use an animal from a Gentile for a korban. Now, it's a very famous story in the Talmud of a man, a Gentile named Dama ben Nesina, who sold the Parah Aduma. Right? Remember that story with his father? He didn't want to disturb his father's sleep for the gems. So the following year, he sold them a Parah Aduma. How could they accept a Parah Aduma from a Gentile for all the reasons I just mentioned? So it could be, says the Gemara, that a Parah Aduma should be treated differently. Parah Aduma is not really Kodshim Haguf. Parah Aduma is the work for a Parah Aduma for the red heifer, whose ashes are used to purify the death defilement, is not, the work for it is not done in the Beis HaMikdash. It's done outside the Beis HaMikdash. So it really has like a din of Kiddushas Damim. Okay, anyway, but here we do see that the Gentile, Aravna, is giving David all these fat animals. Morigim are fatlings, right? And he even gave him clay bucko la'itzim. A little bit of a Hora Shah going on here. Hakol nasan Aravna ha-melech la-melech. Right. Rav Havna, the king, gave it to the king. Rav Ravna HaLamelech, Hashem Elokecha Yirtzecha. May the Lord your God find your service pleasing, which is another way of saying, may the pestilence end. Was Ravna aware of the pestilence? Surely if pestilence is attacking the Jews, it's attacking everybody. Well, you know, in 6 hours, you may not really be able to tell what you might miss some people, right? But if it hits 70,000 people so quickly, it looks like a pandemic like what hit the Assyrians, right? In Menachem Beis.
Chizkiyahu.
All right, so Aravna doesn't seem to be aware of this, but he just says, may your God hear your prayers, and may if this is the answer that the prophet told you how to end this pestilence, let's do it. Do it quickly. Okay. V'yemar melech al Aravna, lo ki kano ekneme oscha b'mechir. Right, so because it says, hakol nosan Aravna ha-melech ha-melech, that implies, I mean, you could say I gave it to him for payment, no? Well, no, that's not how we understand it based on this pasuk, is that when it says he gave it to him, he meant it to be a gift, get it? A matana, a netina. So he says, I don't want payment for it. I want this chus. And David says, no, I want this chus. I have to pay for it. Okay, there are three places until now, and including this, where Jews purchased cities and land in Israel. And all three of them are sticking points today. One is here, Jerusalem. Second one is Shechem. Yaakov Davka pays for Shechem. He insists. And the third one is Hebron. And Bereishis, the people in the Bnei Ches, the Hittites, want Avraham to take the land for free. Right, as long as he buries his wife, besoch ami, in the midst of my people. I want you to assimilate, become like one of us. You're a good guy. We're happy to take, even though you're a foreigner, and usually Hittites have very strict laws about how a foreigner can become a citizen. But they led Avraham because Avraham was special. Okay, he's in the Seal of Kim. Fine. But we see that once Avraham insists on burying his wife, Biktzeh HaSadeh, not Besochami, Biktzeh HaSadeh, establishing for the first time what Jews have been doing ever since, is being very serious about burying Jewish people only in a Jewish cemetery. And I've spoken to the most secular of Jews who would never live during their lives anything with Jewish ritual. But David Dafko insist on having a Jewish burial, and they think that clears everything up from before. and the Jewish to be buried in the Jewish area. Okay, I'm not saying everyone is like that, but I know I've known some people who have such a concern, or their children after them. All right, so David insists on paying. I'm not going to offer up freebies to my God. Whenever I offer up, I pay for it. Okay? I'm not going to take it for free, and I insist on paying. Vayiken, unusual terminology for Hebrew, but Vayiken from the Lashon Kinyan. Vayiken David es Hagoren es Habakar b'kesef shkolim chamishim. David paid for the granary, for the animals that he was about to offer, for 50 shekel. Sounds like a bargain? So here it says, b'kesef shkolim chamishim.
Doesn't different how Yamim say that he paid 600? I thought it was 600.
Yes, he paid 600. And the Gemara does point this out. And it says that David wanted to make sure that he had input from all the tribes. Not that David needed to raise money. The king has a nice treasury, and I'm sure he has plenty of money to purchase any size field. The difference is that he wants to make sure that no tribe feels left out of this place. Right? So David elicits the participation of each tribe, and he feels that, okay, 50 shekel for each tribe is doable. Right?
Thanks.
50 shekel is about, at this time, is about a half a year's salary. Okay? Remember, there's a guy at the end of Sefer Shoftim? All right, but that's like a rabbi's salary. Can't bring a raya from that. There's a guy who's being paid 10 shekel for the whole year. Right?
Yes.
Okay? So he's like, he's like the Kohen. And it's, all right, he might have had some other perks. Maybe he had a cell phone in the deal and maybe car insurance. But the shekel was quite the valuable thing then. Okay. All right. And in Divrei Yomim, it's 600 shekel, as Zach pointed out. And there it says in gold. Okay, because a shekel of kesef weighs different than a shekel of gold. All right, so the Gemara has discussed the relative weights, but that he paid the higher weight. But the discrepancy between 50 and 600 is explained through the ratio I just mentioned. But even Shom David Mizbeach Hashem. So David did indeed build a Mizbeach, as he was told. And David did hear what his fiduciary obligation is for his nation, to do whatever he feels he needs to do in order to end the problem. He did so back in chapter 22 by allowing the Givonim to kill 7 descendants of Shaul. And it says there too, after he gave over the 7 descendants, and then the famine ended. And after he took care of this Goren and set in motion what we read in Divrei Hayamim, then Vatayatzer HaMagefa Me'al Yisrael, and the pestilence ended 60 hours early, 66 hours early. Because it just went from the morning till noon on the first day. I admit that 3 days might have been that it took some days to percolate, like in Makas Dever, like when Moshe said, "Ineyad Hashem ho yob b'miknech," and then the people didn't die right away. But that can go out of the way with that. But David has this obligation to assure that whatever the situation I have to do, it's my responsibility. The buck stops with me to save the day. As opposed to Shaul, who, when facing mortal threats from the Plishtim, amasses great armies to chase after David. Really, it's really became a very, very sad figure. Okay, there are stories in all of Nevi'im Rishonim of people who, while fearing that because of a situation that poses itself to me as a leader, that I feel I have to fix, even where it doesn't appear to bear a death penalty, the thing that was done wrong. I don't think you see the death penalty for someone taking spoils from Yericho. Why did David Yehoshua get the idea that Achan deserved to be killed for taking the spoils? Fine him, make him pay fourfold. But where does it say, you know, the same way that Shaul was ready to kill Yonasan for eating some of that honey, right? Remember he ate some honey when Shaul made a cherem, no one should eat till the end of the battle.
Yes.
He was ready in a very cavalier manner. And for his part, Yonasan was ready to die for it. Said, yeah, Dad, I ate it. Kill me now. Remember that?
The nation didn't
love him. It said the people saved Yonasan.
Only that the people saved him. Yeah, because they said, how could it be if he really sinned? Because God didn't appear to Shaul. Shaul called for an oracle, and Shaul felt that the oracle didn't come to me because God turned away from the camp due to the cherem that was broken. The same way that God turned away from the camp because of Achan breaking the cherem. In the next battle, you see, maybe Yehoshua misinterpreted. Why did Bnei Yisrael lose their second battle after Yericho? Give me the full reason in the Bible.
They went out with very few people.
Correct. They became cocky after the first battle went so significantly in their favor. They said, we don't need any 2,000 people. So if they had fought with the normal exigencies of war, with the proper amount of soldiers, all right, fair is fair. We'll see who are better fighters. But when you feel that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is fighting on your behalf because of how greatly successful you were in the first battle in Yericho, but due to a cherem that was violated, that Hashkacha Pratis is not fighting in your favor, right? The Dafka not fighting in your favor because the cherem pushed God away. So Yehoshua is reacting in the same way that Shaul reacts. And I might add, think of another leader who does something similar.
Another leader?
Who, because of an oath or a cherem, you know, God doesn't call the cherem.
Yeah, so Gideon. Gideon.
Yiftah.
Yeah, the correct Yiftah, answer is
that's Yiftah. Right, Yiftah's daughter.
Correct answer is Yiftah with his daughter, who is also quite cavalier. The daughter, I'm saying, she acts like Yonasan. Oh, Dad, of course. I mean, it's obvious. Only she doesn't know what the cherem was. She doesn't know what Yiftah had promised. She just knows she's part of it. He says, and you're part of it. He uses the Lashon Achar also there, like by Achan. And then you're part of why I'm so upset. And she doesn't even ask, what did you say, Daddy? She just says, Dad, you know, if leaders of Israel make these oaths to God in the heat of battle, and then God responds and makes them successful, but they don't come through, God's going to stop taking the leader's success seriously. So you better, Dad, you better do what you said you would do. But Machlokes, we discussed it so many times in this year, in different settings, what he actually did to her. Chazal seemed to be okay with the fact that he killed her. And Rishonim seemed to move in the direction that he sent her away to live in seclusion. But be it as it may, we see this cavalier approach towards even in cases that involve killing, killing the violator. And in the case of two of them, it's their own progeny. Right? In Greek literature, you have similar things where generals are ready to kill their child for breaking some kind of a taboo or a promise or something. Okay, so maybe we can contrast that with David, who even though he might have been, at some point he should say, we have to kill Avshalom. It's going to be the only way to do this. But he's so distraught, even after all Avshalom had done, right? And yet Shaul and Yiftach are so cavalier about, certainly Shaul is. Okay, Yonasan, come on. the heir to my throne, I'm going to kill you for eating some honey. You see how, you know, because it's his fiduciary obligation to make sure that we win the battles. And it seems to me that God has turned his back on us the way he did with Achan, because someone broke my cherem. Whether it was smart or not for Yehoshua to make such a cherem on the spoils of Yericho, or for Shaul to make such a cherem on not eating until the battle is over, that's a different story.
But Achan knew about it and Yonatan didn't.
Yes, yes. That might go a long way with explaining why Bnei Israel felt that Yonatan did not deserve to die.
Of course not.
Plus the fact that there's a fundamental difference between Achan and Yonatan is the fact that due to Achan's activities, people died and the battle was lost.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The people argued. We say these psukim in Vitan Lecho, if you say that at the end of Shabbos. People argued that how can you say God turned his back on us as a result of Yonatan's rebellion, so to say, his even unknowing rebellion, when his actions specifically led to such a success against the Philistines? He led to Yeshua. The same argument made by the Ran, for instance, in Maseches Chulin, where it discusses that the actions of Eliezer, Eved Avraham, in choosing a wife for Yitzchak would otherwise violate the conventions of Lo Senachashim. Kol Nachash She'eno Eliezer Eved Avraham. And by the way, then it says, Ubi Yonasan Ben Shaul, Eino Nachash. So Tosfos discusses whether Ben Noach has to keep Kishuf or not, But the Ran argues, no, the Gemara doesn't mean to say that he sinned, even though there is a separate Gemara in Tainus that says Shlosha Shalu Shaloka Hogan, that three people made ill-conceived deals with God, and Eliezer was one of them, because maybe a blind or crippled or Canaanite woman would have come out fulfilling his deal. But be that as it may, the Gemara in Chulin, the Ran argues, can't mean that Eliezer Eved Avraham committed a sin in the way he appointed got a wife for Yitzchak, because he ended up being so successful. God came through exactly with his wish for the camels and the water, right? So how could you say that that's a sin? I'll admit this can be dangerous. We can't always assume that just because something went well, that's a sign of God's, acceptance. You know, there is still tzadik paralo in Rosh Hashanah. That's behaving like Achav, right? Remember Achav is arguing with Eliyahu. He says, right before Achav comes to tell Eliyahu tells Achav that there's going to be a drought. It says in the Radak brings down this medrash that they went to pay a shiva call, and coming full circle now, a shiva call to a man named Chiel. Anybody remember what happened to Chiel?
Yeah, because
he lost his son died. Because right. he rebuilt Yericho.
I'm very, very proud of this group today, yes. So he rebuilt Yericho, and not only was it about the cherem, about the spoils, but also about the naming the city and rebuilding it. So he built it and killed two sons in the process, as Yehoshua had said. So they went to pay a shiva call, and Achav started to mock the whole thing. He said to Eliyahu, who's greater? This is an amazing medrash, by the way. Who's greater, Moshe or Yehoshua? So Eliyahu said, Moshe's greater. So he said, but Yehoshua's gzeira, that the one who would rebuild Yericho should kill his two sons in the process, but I flout Moshe's promise all the time. It says worship of Avodah Zarah, you're not going to get rain. And I worship every Avodah Zarah in the world. And we have all the rain we need. You know, in the time of Achav, the Jews were more prosperous than any other time. He extended the borders significantly. Right? So that's where Eliyahu said, you chutzpah! Right? Now you'll see what kind of drought can come because of your behavior, right? So, okay. The Tanakh is just filled with these kind of ironies. All right, Chevra, we just finished Shmuel Bet. It's a great simcha. I love Shmuel so much. I'm thinking of the following for next year, but to move to Sefer Tehillim. I don't recall if we've done Tehillim in a long, long time. And I know Tehillim is you know, is a book you say, but it's also a book you learn. But what I want to do is show that Tehillim, more often than we think, is actually a response to the events in David's life, not just between chapter 50 and 60 and a few chapters here and there, but all the chapters of Tehillim relate to different stages in David's life. The first thing we'll have to do is to find five or six stages in David's life. There are five books of Tehillim, and then connect them to the stories in Shmuel, to the Prokem in Tehillim. If anyone has any other ideas, I'm not fully committed to that topic yet, but I'm trying to. I always like to think in the last classes of the year what are good ideas for the following year. Okay, so that next week I will be on my way to Israel, Mitzshem, and I thank you all for joining me and all this beautiful learning this year.